This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
Looking for a job is lonely. Endless searching, phone calls that go nowhere, applications that vanish into thin air. What if you could link with dozens of local companies who are hiring right now with just one connection? That's Express Employment Professionals. Find us at expresspros.com. One connection, endless opportunities, and no fees ever for job seekers. Express Employment Professionals. Expresspros.com.
Layla Rahimi, Marshall Harris, middays 10 a.m. to 2 on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Yeah, all these guys are capable of really producing with the ball in their hand, and it also puts a lot of stress on the defense where, you know, we're looking at good looks, and that plays right into Ben's hands in terms of how he wants to attack each week.
I was Ryan Poles, as we know, and we go to the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline to bring in our next guest on Rahimi and Harris, Dan Wiederer in. For Marshall Harris, it is our friend Mike Sando of The Athletic at work again, this time writing articles about what other executives think about other teams' drafts. Always nice to talk to Mike, especially after the quarterback tier story and the beast that just came out where they, again, upgraded that user interface online. So, Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I can't take credit for the beast, but it does look pretty good on there, doesn't it?
Well, you know, I said that because we've had Dane on, of course, Dane Brugler. But after you and I talked about the graphic support, I think that went with the quarterback team story, I couldn't help but notice that they did the same thing with the beast.
Yeah, we have a good team, and it's really made progress in that area. I think a lot of our stuff looks better, and agreed, the beast was, that had to be a beast to do for such a big document.
Well, now we get to follow up with the draft, and I think it's a really cool concept, the idea of being able to talk to other executives, remaining anonymous about other teams' drafts. So naturally, we wanted to get your gauge on what was said about the Bears. What were your main takeaways?
Generally positive. You know, I think they can see it's a coach-driven draft at the top when you're taking two weapons like that. And maybe that's okay because your coach is the star of the show now, and he did such a great job in Detroit with the pieces he had. So there's probably a little bit of trust that, you know, people think highly of Ben Johnson and think that if he likes a couple guys here, that he's going to be able to get the use out of them. It was interesting before the draft, you know, some of the rankings had had Ty Warren, who ended up being drafted by the Colts at 14 as the top tight end. But the people that I talked to thought it was going to be Colston Loveland, who the Bears took, just because he's more dynamic as a receiver. So I think that was generally applauded. You know, they've thrown a lot at the receiver and tight end positions. So, you know, that's okay because they did address their offensive line quite a bit earlier this offseason. I'd say just generally, you know, generally pretty positive and understanding of what the Bears are doing.
Mike, the Loveland buzz has been louder and certainly more amplified after the draft than it was before the draft. What is your sense of what excites people around the league at what his potential is, obviously playing in an offense that should feature him?
Yeah, well, just the ability to get open, which isn't a given with tight ends. There's different types of tight ends. Some of them are, you know, better blockers. Some of them are, you know, well-rounded, pretty good at both blocking and receiving. But I think what's differentiating the guys at the top, usually, if you want to take one early, is their ability to separate and get open on their own. So people think he can do that. And that's, like I said, that differentiates him a little bit in the minds of some from the second tight end in the draft, Warren. So that's what it is, ability to, you know, to almost operate like a receiver from the tight end position.
I think it's also valuable when it comes to just the overall impression of, we've asked the question before, whose draft is this? And that was one where the pick was so indicative of the hallmarks of a Ben Johnson need. You know, what was your takeaway when it came to that part of this? Was not just the comments about Ben Johnson's needs specifically, but the overall draft.
Yeah, agreed. And I also think that it was a draft where, by the time the Bears were picking, it wasn't like there was a no-brainer person to pick. You kind of had your choice of a lot of different things, right? You could say in some other years, even last year, you know, it worked out a little similarly where, like, Joe Alt was this great tackle available and he ended up not being available by the time the Bears picked, I think, at number 9. But, you know, if there's somebody like that, that's just a no-brainer. But if they were going to address, you know, people wanted them to get a running back, well, there isn't really one you're going to take there, you know, at 10. Offensive line, yeah, there were some kind of guard tackle types, but you did that in free agency. You didn't necessarily have to do that. So, you know, I did think it set up a little bit more easily to take a piece that the coach likes, as opposed to feeling like, oh my gosh, the number one corner's available, we have to get him. There weren't players like that in this draft at number 10.
Mike, on day two, they picked Luther Burden, and it's another weapon for Ben and Caleb to utilize. There was some sentiment initially that that's a luxury pick for this team, given where they're at. And then there's this post-draft buzz that best case scenario is Luther Burden becomes a Pro Bowl difference maker for your offense for a long time. What's your sense on kind of how he's viewed and kind of the pluses and minuses of making that pick where they made it?
Yeah, I think you could find many mock drafts before the draft that had him going a lot earlier, going in the first round. So I think people are understanding of the value looks like you're getting in the second round, and think that, you know, it could be a little bit of a luxury because you've got other receivers. Now, they have different skill sets, so I'm not saying he's the same as all the other receivers, but, you know, if you want the ball in somebody's hands, you could say DJ Moore could, you know, do some things after the catch as well. So I think that's a fair point to bring up. You know, you could call it a criticism that, you know, maybe it was a bit of a luxury pick. I think it was interesting that, you know, the pick before that the Patriots took Travion Henderson, the running back. I think that's interesting. I probably could have got into that in the analysis, probably should have. But I thought what was interesting about that is that Henderson is seen as a pass protection piece, not just a runner. Really could help your pass protection. He's a great, willing pass blocker. So, you know, if both those players were available at that pick, you'd probably lean towards Henderson, right?
No doubt. And I think, there was a push to try to make that happen. And then they had to, I don't want to say settle, but, you know, pivot, I guess, is a better way to put it.
Well, and we've been trying, Mike, to figure out what the Bears' counterpunch was after that, because then they go another 6 rounds before they get a running back. You know, they go to the 7th round. So that's been a discussion that we've been having, is just the thought on if that was truly a position of need versus them talking a lot about their board.
Yeah. That's a fair point. I mean, certainly they could have taken one earlier, but, you know, as sometimes there's, you really only like certain players, right? So there could be other backs that they would have been fine with, but it just didn't feel like it was adding what they wanted to add at the expense of something else they could have gotten later in the draft. Like, you know, I think people liked they took an offensive lineman at 56. People like that pick. You know, that maybe if you're going to do luxury with Burden, you come back with meat and potatoes with offensive line, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, and then we're like, okay, now we're 3 picks into this thing. We haven't taken anyone on defense. So, okay, let's get this defensive tackle, Turner, right?
Yep.
And so you can kind of see how that goes. And now, we don't like these packs that are here in this next range the same. That's how that happens.
I think also when it came to just the executive opinion, you know, that was addressed in some of these quotes. Like, for example, when they're talking about, well, that's a lot of resources at the tight end position, that there is some acknowledgement of either perhaps some overlapping positional possible redundancy or an understanding of the availability of what was there at the draft that they wanted.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And when I look at where they were, so remember I said, like at 132, they took the linebacker. Well, at that point, you know, a running back had come off five picks before. Another one had come up, two others had come off a couple before that. Scadaboo had come off. People, a lot of people liked him, special teams guys. So, you know, that's the board falls how it falls. And if you want to make a maneuver and move up to get a guy, you're going to pay for that. And it may just not have seemed worth it to them. And I think you have to trust Ben Johnson a little bit in terms of what he has on offense, what he thinks he needs, and he got what he wanted. Oh, clearly, they didn't pass on a running back when he wanted to have one. I would almost guarantee that.
Mike, two-part question here. You had quoted an executive in your piece about Ozzie Trapillo saying that he could be the sleeper of this class for the Bears. I'm curious what kind of buzz you heard about what makes him that. And then on a bigger picture sort of look, when you draft a tackle in a top 60 of a draft, what have to be the realistic expectations for what he is going to be for you, for your football team for the long haul?
I think that high, you're hoping to get a starter. It may not be a starter right away, but I think you'd really like to get a starter out of that second pick, and maybe he starts, you know, maybe it's the second year or whatever. But, you know, I think he played a lot of right tackle in Bill O'Brien's offense there at Boston College. So, you know, I believe the Bears have Darnell Wright there, correct?
Correct.
Yes.
And so we'll see what the future is for him, you know, and where he's going to go. But that could be, you know, this could be a swing tackle, somebody for you. This could be, you know, an eventual starter at right tackle, depending what you think is going to happen with, you know, with Wright in terms of either changing positions or where he fits into their future on an extension, those sorts of things. You can't have enough of those guys at that position. And so if you like a guy, you take him and you work him into the mix.
Mike, I know that you've mentioned the Bears is getting high marks from this random executive pool that you talked to. But what was another team in the NFC that stood out to people as far as how they performed in the draft?
People loved the Rams getting a first-round pick next year. Sometimes those first-round picks seem really great, don't they, until you have to actually use them. But the idea of doing that when you need... you may need a quarterback next year. I think a lot of people like that. People didn't like the other side of it with Atlanta giving that away, even though they liked some of their players. You know, let's see. I scroll through some of these teams. I think people liked... you know, you could kind of... the Giants. I think the Giants were another one as I go through this, just because the market sort of proved they were correct in not taking a quarterback at two. There's sort of debate of like how early do they need to take a quarterback? They or at three, I guess they took Abdul Carter instead of kind of panicking and taking, you know, Shedeur Sanders or Jackson Dart or somebody that they liked at three because they felt like they needed to have a quarterback. So I think that was decent, good process. And then, you know, I don't know if Jackson Dart's going to be any good, but you know, at least addressed that position, got the next quarterback and somebody they obviously liked. So, and then Cam Scadaboo also was seen as an interesting pick in the fourth round, running back who could kind of almost affect your culture just by the way he plays on special teams and the energy he brings. I think that was a pick that I talked to more than one executive who was like trying, you know, hoping that their team would have taken him.
Yeah, no doubt about that. I think he was on the radar here as well. Layla mentioned earlier your QB tiers piece, and that's one of those annual summer Christmas morning pieces where you're pretty excited for it to come out. I'd imagine that even though that doesn't launch until August, you're well on your way to compiling some of this, correct?
You really can't start till after the draft because that's when you know who's starting in the different places, right?
Okay.
So you can't. We had to see who's going to draft quarterbacks, where's Russell Wilson going to land, all those types of things. So then get going, you know, a little bit here soon.
Aaron Rodgers also on that list. I'm just curious, what do you expect you might hear that be the first year that Caleb Williams will be folded into that? Because obviously rookies aren't eligible for it. But what do you expect to hear? What are some of your early takes on where Caleb is right now?
Yeah, probably some criticism of his first year playing and taking too many sacks, you know, and just probably not being as good as people thought he was going to be. You could say what you want about the situation around him. And then I think there'll be talk about what Ben Johnson can do with him and how Ben Johnson is, you know, I think Ben Johnson's a little bit of an old school coach. I think he coaches people hard and holds them accountable. So I think that'll be an interesting situation for Caleb Williams there in Chicago.
Mike, I do remember talking to you about Lamar Jackson pretty intently after the last one came out. Does anything change after this past season? Because I thought he was a tier lower.
Well, he was right on the edge of tier one and tier two. So, you know, I would imagine that he would bump into tier one. I would think so after last year. Yeah.
I was curious about that. Not that I need to scoreboard anybody. Goodness knows I've been wrong on a million things, but I did wonder if his past season would put him back in that top tier.
Well, he has never been there before in tier one. He's always been close, but you know, I think the way he's not so much this year or even last, but you know, the way that it hasn't translated to the postseason and you know, has kept him sort of, and concerns about his passing in the past, you know, kept him a little bit lower. But he really moved right to the edge of it this last year. And so I'm going to look at it. I was going to look at it now. It's not popping up, but just, he was close. He had a lot of tier one votes. So I would think that enough of those would swing over. He'll be in tier one with probably Patrick Mahomes, Joe Burrow, Josh Allen, and we'll see who else.
Mike, we look forward to it. And until then, we get to check out not only your story about executives talking about the draft, but I know one was just released, executives talking about free agency as well. So we will look forward to those. And thanks for joining us here on Raheemy and Harris on The Score.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Nice to talk to Mike Sando always, especially when there is that embarrassment of riches resource-wise there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like that's something you look forward to, too, the quarterback tiers.
Oh, yeah, because it's so informed, right? Like that's the best part of it is it's not Mike's rankings, right? Like Mike reaches out all over the league and gets such a wide array of opinions that help you crystallize how the entire league views all of these quarterbacks. And it's fascinating to see how it stacks up every year.
Well, and I thought that it was compelling that the Giants got such high marks for their draft after everything that happened.
Sure.
We're still trying to figure out. Right now, they still have four quarterbacks in the room, right? They haven't made a move on DeVito yet, have they?
No.
Your guy.
ILL.
I, right?
See, I got you to do it. There you go.
I like the Illini.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Making financial decisions shouldn't feel like picking a TV show. Too many options, too much hype, and no way to know what's actually good. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast cuts through the clutter. Their finance journalists break through real-world money decisions with clear, research-backed insights. From investing to home buying to credit cards, the nerds help you navigate major financial decisions with confidence. Leave TV to fate. Leave your next financial move to the nerds. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.
Do you know about the true crimes that inspired a Bruce Springsteen album? Or the murders AC/DC was blamed for? How about Taylor Swift's violent stalkers? Or the suspicious deaths of Brittany Murphy and River Phoenix? These stories and more are told in the Disgraceland podcast, hosted by me, Jake Brennan, every Tuesday, where I dive deep into subjects from the dark side of music history and entertainment. So follow and listen to Disgraceland on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1970, Richard Nixon was in the White House. The floppy disk was invented. A U.S. postage stamp cost 6 cents. And Nancy Faust commenced her career with the Chicago White Sox.
Hello again, everybody. Harry Carey from Comiskey Park. It's Nancy Faust night. And the weatherman has proven that he is a Nancy Faust fan, too, because this is the best weather we've had since the baseball season opened.
So let's go to the PA and enjoy Take Me Out to the Ball Game with Dennis DeYoung.
Nancy!
Oh, is that Nancy Faust?
It is. Sure.
Nancy was...
what a wonderful gal.
She was. Great gal. She was here a long time with the White Sox, but I don't know how we got on that cover. I don't know what it was.
Dubbed baseball's best organist by Sports Illustrated, She was famous for punctuating the game and opposing player at bat music with personal and witty melodic interludes while entertaining millions of fans.
Nancy really contributed to the festive atmosphere at Old Comiskey Park. I mean, think about it. She invented "Nah, nah, hey, hey, goodbye" as a "see you later" to an opponent.
She's a Chicago legend. Let's face it.
She did the Harold, Harold.
By the way, Dick Allen was her favorite player, and when he came up to bat, he would play Jesus Christ Superstar, was exactly what he was, a superstar.
She's such a wonderful woman and beloved by White Sox fans.
Spiegel and Holmes, afternoons on The Score.
No doubt about it, one of the musical soundtracks to multiple generations of White Sox fans is Nancy Faust playing the organ at a game, whether we're talking about player walk-ups or during rain delays. Nancy was there for White Sox fans, and now she's going to be back on Sunday, starting this Sunday over at 35th and Shields, and we could not be happier to have Nancy with us here on the Circa Sports Illinois Hotline. Download the Circa app today. Nancy, thanks so much for joining us. We truly appreciate it.
Well, that was quite a compilation. I'd forgotten about so many of those wonderful words, and how did you do that?
Our guy Chris Tannehill, Nancy, lifelong White Sox fan and sound archivist, worked on that with love. That's for sure.
Well, that had to take him a month to compile all that. Thank you very much. Boy, you just made my head explode.
Oh, it's awesome. Nancy Faust with me, Matt Spiegel, and with Lawrence Holmes. What a pleasure it is, and what a pleasure it was to read this news, Nancy. 41 years with the White Sox, but then 15 years away, 15 years in the making. And here
that
it
is. Right.
And so here it is happening. Like, had you lost hope that it was going to happen? And how did you feel when you realized you're going to get a chance to come back and do these six Sundays?
Oh, I felt every emotion imaginable, Matt and Lawrence. I'd kind of given up going back. I'd been doing some minor league games, but I just felt that my time at the majors was beyond gone. So when I got the call, I was just elated. And of all things, it's on Mother's Day, and I'm excited that it's actually the same year that Dick Allen will be inducted into the Hall of Fame. I championed for that for a few years now, and so all the stars aligned, and I'm just, I'm ecstatic. Well, actually, and I went to the game, to the ballpark today, brought my equipment there. We had a sound check, and oh gosh, the sound system is just as good as imaginable. It's wonderful. So I felt right at home. It was almost as though I hadn't left by the time I finished my, I've learned about a dozen songs today.
You were the one of the things you said was on a list of questions that I had for you, because you're right. You were one of the biggest advocates for Dick Allen getting into the Hall of Fame. For you, having your career connected to his career and being a fan of his, how happy are you about it that he finally gets recognized the way he deserved to be?
Well, I've come to realize that not only was he a spectacular player, but such a great human being. And those that really knew him couldn't say enough about him. He was generous and thoughtful and had a lot of pride, and which he certainly did deserve. And I finally met him, maybe 15 years ago when at the ballpark when there was a reception for him. And he just couldn't have been nicer and more gracious. And he acted appreciative of the song that I played for him. It was actually, it was like a knee-jerk reaction when I played Jesus Christ Superstar, because that song was popular when he came up to bat, and he always performed so well that it was just like a no-brainer. And then Sports Illustrated picked up the fact that he had his own song, and that encouraged me to play more special songs for players, and that evolved into what we now call walk-up music. But Dick Allen kind of started it, so he kind of put me on the map, I guess. But nobody like him, and I'm just thrilled for him, and I wish he were here to realize it, but I know his family and friends are equally as ecstatic as I am.
I bet some of our listeners, Nancy, are just putting it together as you're saying it. Now, I want to just go ahead and knock it all the way through here. Nancy Faust invented the walk-up song. So this is the early 70s. She plays Jesus Christ Superstar for Dick Allen, and people catch on. And now, all over sport, every sport, you know, an appropriate song for the hometown player. It's everywhere. And it is a phenomenal and beautiful legacy that you get to share with Dick Allen. I know that you have some friends that are organists in MLB, but you must have heard from all kinds of people. Who do they treat you with the respect you deserve as the innovator of the walk-up song is the question.
Well, you know, the term walk-up song wasn't developed until it was the players that selected their songs. And when I did that same thing, it was my choice, and I felt that I was actually playing to amuse and entertain the fans, not so much the players. And I don't think they were even tuned into what I was playing, which was often a good thing. But so things have turned around since then. And now what I do is I play walk-up music for the opposing team because the home team gets to select their own music. And sometimes it's something you may have never heard. I tried to make it more mainstream where somebody could actually make a connection between the name, the number, the ethnic group, or whatever, just some kind of a connection, association. I guess you'd... It evolved to what you call walk-up music now, but it started, I'd say, with Dick Allen.
How did practice go today?
Good question.
It was glorious. It was glorious. I was a little unnerved when I first sat down, but by the time I was through it, I just felt very comfortable, and I was really encouraged to hear the sound system because it just sounds so wonderful. Makes me sound so good.
What's the instrument? What are you playing? Is there still an organ there, or did you provide one?
We provide one because it's what I'm used to using, and it's very much like a Hammond B3, but it's cut down so it doesn't take so much room. But you get the same effect as you would with the Hammond B3. I have lots of pedals and two full keyboards, and I use a sequencer, which I've put background music into so I can play along with myself, and it enhances what I sound like. And I also have an automatic drum now. These are things I didn't have when I started back in 1970.
Amazing. Nancy Faust with us here on Spiegel and Olms on The Score. Lawrence, I have three musical friends in Chicago, Max Crawford, Gerald Dowd, Kelly Hogan, when Josh Cantor, the organist at Fenway Park, the Red Sox organist who grew up idolizing Nancy Faust, found out Nancy was selling her practice organ, he bought it.
That's right.
And then his friends picked up the organ and drove it to Boston. And they documented, they called it the Great American Organ Transplant. They stopped in Cooperstown, where the Hall of Fame welcomed them with Nancy Faust's practice organ. And I was there the day it got delivered into Josh Cantor's house, Nancy.
Is that a fact?
So that your legacy is directly connected to one of the finest active organists in Major League Baseball. He still has your practice organ, and I think he uses it all the time. It's amazing.
Oh, that's so great to hear. He's a great guy, and he's very talented, and he's also a music, and he's got an encyclopedic brain in terms of, putting the artist with the song. He's just really, there's nobody like him. And
He takes requests every night.
He wanted the organ. He is a Chicagoan originally.
Yes.
Of course, now he's in, there he is in Boston.
He takes requests every night, Nancy, on Twitter. It's like, but there's only 10 or 11 teams that use an organist these days. Why don't more teams use an organist these days?
Well, you've got to find somebody that can execute. You know, if you have to refer to organ music, or if you have to refer to any kind of music, you're dead because there's no time. The game has been sped up so much. So that's part of the problem. I think so many musicians like to have music for everything, and it's hard to be spontaneous that way. I guess they're doing quite well without, but I do know that those that are active are making quite an impact. So that's great. I know we've got the organist in Atlanta and the Dodgers, and Diamondbacks, and it's good to know that there can be a place if they do it well.
Nancy, how did you figure out that you could marry these two passions, baseball and music?
That was just an accident because I really I didn't grow up in a sports-oriented family. We had never been to ball games or anything like that. But my mother was a musician, and I just filled in at playing at a luncheon that was attended by Stu Holcomb, who was the general manager of the White Sox. And that was back in probably 69 or 70. Well, 70 was my first year, so it might have been early 70. And so he attended this luncheon, and he heard me, and evidently they were ready to make a change for their organist, because they had a fella there that had been there several years. Now, the original organist at the ballpark was hired by Bill Veeck in 1960, and then around in 1967, he moved down to California, and he ended his career he played out there for many years for the Angels. His name was Shea Torrent. He was really good. But anyhow, then somebody followed him, and the Sox must have been ready to make a move, and they heard me play and offered me the job after I expressed interest.
When you get that opportunity, like, do you even have a sense of what it is when you're not around it all the time? Like, what did they say they wanted you to do?
Play the national anthem. That was before we had guest singers. And to play Take Me Out to the Ball Game, and Occasional Charge. And I remember my mom saying, now they say when they take a pitcher out, they're going to the showers, so you have to play April Showers. So I did that. But it kind of grew from there, because nowadays you have social media with a cast of thousands giving you great ideas. But because the organ was located among the among the fans who were so knowledgeable, I gained a lot of insight and good ideas I could execute if they could just give me the name of a song. And it was just a good marriage between the fans and myself, the fact that I was outside, that was Bill Veeck's idea. And so it was a great marriage.
And your remarkable musical brain to think of stuff and do it on the fly, and the courage to do it. So April Showers was for when the home team had a pitching change?
No.
Okay. Because when did you start doing na 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 hey hey goodbye when the opposing team had a pitching change?
Well, that just kind of that just happened too. It was nothing planned. I actually started playing that around the same time that 1977, when I thought that would be a good song, because I knew the words goodbye were in it, and I thought, oh, if opposing hitter struck out, that goodbye is a good song to play. So I actually played it for just a strikeout. But when I did play it, when a pitcher was removed and we were playing Kansas City and vying for first place, the fans were electric, and they were just there to chime in. And I remember walking through the Bards room after the game, and the press saying to me, what was that that you played that everybody sang? All I knew was that the word goodbye was in it. And I said, oh, the name of that song is Sha-na-na, Sha-na-na, goodbye. So that's how little I knew about the song, but I had a good lyric, and that was goodbye. But it held, because, it was pretty sensational to hear everybody singing. In those days, the only thing they sang was Take Me Out to the Ball Game. So it became our anthem for quite a number of years.
Nancy, I got to tell you that, and I'm not a musician, so you can help me with this, but hearing the first four notes of that is something that is forever stuck in my head.
Do, 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 do.
The walk of do, 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 do.
Ah.
Hearing that.
That's about as original as I can get for an introduction. Four notes. Dun, dun, dun.
I love that. It is, as a fan, it's stuck in my head. It's a call to arms for what's getting ready to happen. You know what I mean? I love that.
Yes, I do. Yeah. Everybody needs an introduction. So everything. Yeah. A call to arms. I love that. Thank you.
Nancy Faust is living, breathing White Sox history. 41 years of the ballpark, and now back for six Sundays, beginning this Sunday, which is Mother's Day. Is the story true that the only games you ever missed were because of the birth of your child?
Right. In fact, I brought him. We brought him home from the hospital on Mother's Day. That was May 6th. Today is his birthday, as a matter of fact. But he was born, he was May 6th. And then the Sox went out of town. They were on the road for maybe a week or 10 days after that. So I stayed home for a while, for a week. And when the Sox returned, I was ready to go back to work. It's not even work. It's a party. You know, I was happy to return to the party. So, that's how that all happened.
Oh, yes.
Those are the only games I missed, over 3,000 of them.
Over 3,000 games, those are the only ones you missed. I mean, yeah,
that Iron Woman streak is strong.
Yeah, that's she's the Lou Gehrig of White Sox organism. I mean, that's unbelievable. But you said it's a party. Like when you were outside and you were, cause you were in a couple different spots, but you were in the outfield for a while, right? I remember you and Harry being out there together.
That's where the organ was first placed when Bill Veeck introduced an organ at the park. He's placed it in the center field bleachers and it had somewhat of a tent out there, but there was very few people out there. Well, particularly that first year, I think they had maybe the lowest attendance ever. So that's where a good place for me to get my start. And then Harry came the second year and said, you ought to bring her in where she's closer to the fans. So in 1972, I was moved from the center field bleachers to directly behind home plate. And that is also the year that Dick Allen joined the team. So it was just a great time to be among fans. And I was feeling very comfortable by then. And I was getting good feedback and everything. I knew I was on top of the world. I knew I had the best job in the world.
Did fans?
It's not a job. It was an assignment, or that was just perfect.
Did fans? Were they able to get close enough? Did they put beers on the organ? Did they spill beers on the organ ever?
No, but they were very close, you know, but we never had a problem. You know, I remember an Andy Frayn usher standing near me, but it wasn't necessary. Everybody was just having a good time. I mean, it was just a grand party. So,
Nancy, what does it mean to you? Like you have connected so many generations of White Sox fans, and you know, I'm getting ready to turn 50, but you've been gone so long that this now gives you an opportunity to reach a couple new generations of fans. So for you, being able to connect all of that history back to 1970 to now 2025 and the young people that are going to be there on Sunday that have the chance to experience you sharing your art and your craft, what does it mean to you to be put in this position?
I realize that there might be almost a whole generation of fans that haven't experienced live organ music at a game, but I expect that they'll be there with their parents or their grandparents who did experience me, and it's something for them to share. It's something for the dad to say, oh, that's this song, or that's why she played that, and this is how it was when I was young and when I was your age. So I think there will be a lot to share among the generations if these kids are there. And I hope I can connect in some way. I have learned some songs that they may know. I'm going to learn my Pink Pony Club. I understand it's very popular. I mean, Dua Lipa or whoever she is, I do a song by her. Taylor Swift, Kendrick Lamar, Billie Eilish. So I've incorporated some songs that I think will be familiar.
Oh, what a fantastic thing.
Like,
yeah, what a fantastic thing for you as an artist to learn new stuff and mix it in. What a thrill.
Not Like Us is perfect for the organ. By Kendrick Lamar?
I think it is. Well, before that, I could play The Times They Are A-Changin', because, boy, what a contrast in music. And I could do it both of them. A medley, perhaps.
Oh, that's phenomenal. But seriously, from an artistic perspective, a musical perspective, and really just an improvisation perspective, the art of you thinking of a song and playing it is a tremendous thing for kids and young musicians to realize is possible. You know, it's like, what a beautiful artistic sensibility for them to experience. That's going to be the big benefit that maybe the White Sox don't even realize, and having you back is like all those young fans are going to feel something and they're going to know that it's special and it's going to connect with them like you always have.
Well, thank you. I certainly hope that all comes to pass. So thank you very much. I like that.
Yeah.
Did you, can you tell people, you mentioned Bill Veeck. Bill Veeck brought an animal to the park that you eventually took home. Is that correct? Can you share that story?
Yeah, in fact, well, as I was waiting for your call, guess what I was doing? Just cleaning a water bucket. But so one of Bill's many promotions was called Ragtime Night. And one of his door prizes, Ragtime Night, besides an old Model T car and an old piano, was they marched they paraded a donkey out into the field. And it was a door prize that wasn't claimed, and it had been donated by one of the amusement parks, I think. Probably it would have been returned, but rather than return, I asked Bill if I could keep it, and he said, sure. So I brought it home to be company for a horse that I had. So that started my romance with donkeys, and I still have two, but not the original ones. But I do have two donkeys.
You continue to have donkeys and keep them because you took one home from Bill Veeck. You're living history. It's unbelievable.
That's the start. He really changed my life in that way because it takes a lot of time and dedication, but I have a passion about it, and I love the animals. And my latest acquisition was just rounded up by the Bureau of Land Management in Arizona, and because they want to clear the lands, the government lands of all the equine. And I got wind that this animal was young and tame enough. So that's my latest donkey, and his name is Jackpot, because we feel that we hit the jackpot when we found him.
That is awesome. Nancy, thank you for your time. We truly appreciate you, and we wanted to share that, and hopefully we have shared how much White Sox fans and baseball fans and Chicagoans absolutely love you. This is a brilliant idea by the White Sox. I love that they're doing this. I love that you get to share your art with everyone again. And thank you for giving us a few minutes of your time.
Well, thank you for such kindness and such kind words. And I look forward to seeing you at the park and both of you and meeting up with people that I haven't seen for 15 years. Sunday.
It's the best. I know
and
a lot.
Happy Mother's Day to everybody listening that's not a father.
right back at you.
Nancy, thank you. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and we can't wait for Sunday.
Too. Thanks, Nancy.
Thank you so much.
You got it.
You guys take it easy. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, this is star level production, no question about it. Like I said, it's been the power lately. But what great players can affect the game is in a lot of ways. And Pete has that ability, and some days it's the defense, some days it's the base running. But he's in a good place right now for sure.
Craig Counsell.
What did he tell us, Lawrence, that we got one of those guys. Last week when we talked to Craig, one of those five-tool dudes who just make you dream about what the possibilities are.
Right. You may have traded for a star and in the process have also found a star. Now, ideally, what you'd love is for those two guys to be on your major league roster for a long time, especially considering the amount of very solid players that you also have and have under contract for a little while.
Joe Posnanski, who writes beautifully about baseball, in his email today said, Pete Crow Armstrong is doing more than just leading the streaking Cubs. He's bringing back the much-missed do-everything superstar center fielder. The position once ruled by Mantle and Mays and Cobb and DiMaggio has been lagging in recent years. Mike Trout's injuries did him in. Byron Buxton's injuries stopped him before he ever got started. We still wait for Julio Rodriguez and, to a lesser extent, Michael Harris II to become transcendent. Now here's Crow Armstrong playing defense like a dream, stealing bases and smashing the ball.
That sounds nice.
Doesn't it? I know. You just want to hang out in that headspace for a little while.
And now that Trout's moved to right field, because he was that for a while.
He was. He absolutely was.
He's three MVPs. It was watching that guy go get it out in center field.
We thought Luis Robert had a chance to be that.
Well, you know what? And I hate to talk about another team's misery, but the Cincinnati Reds have an outfielder who broke his arm last night. So,
I didn't see that. Who broke his arm?
It's Callahan, right? You think it was Callahan who broke his arm last night?
They have
it's tough to come back from those.
Yes, in the same season for sure. I believe they need an outfielder.
Interesting.
Again.
I saw Jim Bowden had like five trades that should be made. I forget where he had Robert going. He had Robert going somewhere as well. So like maybe the dream is alive.
Tyler Callahan, I saw it this morning. He was trying to make a catch down the left field line, and I think he either his arm got underneath him or his arm hit the wall and he broke his arm.
That's brutal.
I knew it was bad because the ball was right next to him. And he didn't even motion towards it. He was hurt so bad.
Oh, Bowden had the Rangers trading for Luis Robert, which is interesting because the Rangers are clearly in an odd, desperate place because there seems to be some good teams out in the American League West, and the Rangers ain't one of them. You see who the Rangers just hired as a hitting coach? Brett Boone.
Booney?
Mark Grody's guy, Booney.
Did Grody break that story?
He should have. He absolutely should have. But yeah, so Bowden had the Rangers going for Luis Robert Jr. for a couple of young prospects.
Yeah, I thought that was the Grody beat.
He's been on the Brett Boone beat for quite some time.
He was on like last week.
Yeah, he was on the
didn't tell him. Yeah. Hey, no. By the way, I'm going to be a Major League Baseball hitting coach.
Right. Keep an eye open for a little something for your guy Booney.
I mean, seriously. Can't
maybe he
that?
Knew and didn't tell us.
I mean, Groats, come on, man. Well, yeah, you know, you're right. He might be protecting a source. Maybe he gets to something down the line, a bigger story down the line.
I wonder if the source is Brett Boone.
Quid pro quo.
Booney.
But anyway, to get back to PCA and this star turn that he is having, we had a really wonderful conversation with Cliff Floyd yesterday. And Spiegs was talking to him about how teammates handle stuff like a guy becoming a star.
So the biggest thing is, you know, when he falls on his face a little bit, right? You got to be there to pick him up, dust him off. Pick him up, dust him off, say, hey, it's going to be all right. You know, like Matt Shaw goes down. Justin Turner, I'm having a conversation with JT. And I was like, Jay, what's up, man? Is this dude going to, like, figure it out? He goes, he'll figure it out, but he has to get out of his own way. He has to figure out how to get to the point where – maybe his batting stance might have to change a little bit. Maybe some things have to move a little bit, but he's going to get it. PCA was able to come up, get a cup of coffee, go home, work on some things. And then he was like, oh, I got this. Like, I can do this every single day. I figured it out. Like, I don't have to, you know, struggle for a long amount of time. I know some pitchers going to get me, going to eat my bat up every once in a while. But tomorrow's a new day. He gets that already.
So PCA sees it. And has made the adjustments. Was up, was down, now is back up. That's interesting because that comes off like an endorsement of process for Matt Shaw as well, and a plea for patience on that front.
Well, the thing is that there is a history of that. Like Ian Happ went down, and if we would have had more time with Carter, I would have loved to know how he would answer the question about what they want Matt Shaw to do because. You don't want to give away the store if the guy does make it back. You don't want to, well, here are the things that we think he's not good at, and then that be something that teams continue to exploit.
No, but you could tell us if there's mechanical changes that are going on. I haven't watched video of what's happening at AAA. I did see Matt Shaw had four hits the other day in a game.
I think Evan Altman's saying that he's getting close, and I trust Evan's eye. Like he is someone that when you talk about like looking at bats and not just making wild proclamations. I have to check Cubs Insider real quick, but I thought I saw him post that.
I got to say, props to Nicky Lopez for just being happy to be here, have a job.
He had a couple of really strong at-bats last night.
He did, and he's been playing a super solid, sensible third base. He had a great play Saturday night. But he also had a bunch of like just really solid plays Saturday night, or I guess it was Friday night, whatever it was. But like just what Vidal Brujan didn't do last Sunday night in terms of attacking a ground ball and understanding the timing of the infield and throwing out a fast runner. Nicky understands like the timing math of the infield, even though he was not a career third baseman. Like you've seen him a couple times, like be pausing, waiting for a hop, and then attacking the ball while going into his throwing motion.
I will tell you that play that he made last night is textbook how you teach to play on your toes at third base. The replay, they had a replay from the left field camera and seeing him bounce as the pitch is thrown and having his momentum going forward. That's the type of geeky bleep that I love about baseball.
That's what it's got to be. And that's what it's got to be when you're at a defensive position. Be the nine hitter and play really good third base defense.
And you can get yourself a major league contract.
Yeah, and maybe you get yourself a postseason share, you know?
Well, he's definitely going to get that now. You know what I mean? Like, he's played enough already to get that.
You might get starts in a pennant race.
Or defensive replacement.
Sure,
you know, sure. Come in to help close a game out. I was right. Evan Altman wrote, Matt Shaw, quote, ready to go back after making adjustments in Iowa. Moises Ballesteros pounding on door.
Ready to go back. Is that a quote or is that Evan's assessment? That's interesting.
Hold on. I'm going to read a paragraph here.
Because we all know what the plan is at third base, because Jed Hoyer told us that hope is the plan. Evan, third base.
Evan wrote yesterday, Matt Shaw started his time back in AAA going 1-17 and looking at least as lost as he'd been in Chicago prior to being demoted. Even after making some adjustments to get back to his natural swing and timing, there were concerns about a lot of grounders and a lack of hard contact. But process is more important than results. And when it comes to sustainable success, and Shaw appears to be getting back to the right place mentally. Quote, when he came back, the confidence was down a little bit. Iowa's Cubs co-hitting coach Rick Strickland told Tommy Burch of the Des Moines Register, of course, it should be. He's struggling, right? So
here are some details a little further down, Lawrence. Thank you for hipping us to this. From Evan, Shaw looked to have narrowed his stance a little and may have been overstriding, which led to his head moving a little too much and his load being too light. That can all be a tricky Ouroboros, thank you, Evan, to undo because the cycle of mental and physical factors feed into one another with no discernible beginning or end. So interesting. So there has been some mechanical stuff to Evan's eye anyway.
And if you're not following Evan and you're a Cub fan, you're doing it wrong. He puts in the work. He covers this team and he shares really, really cool stuff. But again, back to PCA. Because that's where this conversation started, is us talking about PCA. This is what Nico told us a couple hours ago about advice for a budding star like Pete Crow Armstrong.
Yeah, man, I think we've got a pretty great situation in our clubhouse as far as the people that he has around him, and not that he needs a ton of help, but I think we got a nice combination of veterans and people that are pumped to see him succeed, but you know, also give him a healthy amount of grief when he does things that are unique, and so it's all part of it, and it's part of the fun of a season. And if any suggestions from my end, it would just be to continue to be himself and continue to make the energy that he brings every day about winning and about the group. And he's done that and then some, just with his daily work, his actions. I mean, he's the first one in the cage, first one on the field doing early work. Like, there's a lot going on behind the scenes that people don't see, and you know, I hope that's not lost on people, all the work that he's done. Like, he is an incredible talent, but to improve this much at the major league level takes a ton of work, and it's not by chance. He's really earned that, and he's going to keep developing, and who knows what he can be.
I hope that we're talking about this part of the story all year, because that means that the Cubs are having a great season and PCA is an all-star and they're working towards something. It would be fun to, like, at the end of the year, compile all of our Cubs guests talking about this subject.
Mm-hmm. PCA blowing up and making sure he stays himself. Doesn't appear to be a huge challenge right now. He likes being who he is, and they all like him being who he is.
Chaos agent, Pete Crow Armstrong.
preference for chaos, baby.
It's a good thing.
Hey, man, I can't stop looking at this Matt Shaw article. I had missed it. And I'm so glad, because these quotes from the AAA hitting coach, from Rick Strickland.
Give us an idea.
Quote, he's ready. He's ready to go back. Well, that's fascinating. So, like, was he empowered to speak on the entire plan? That's a really good get. That's a really good ask by Evan. That's a really interesting, compelling thought. But I don't know. I mean, maybe he's confident again, and that's really good. But if they didn't fix enough, I'm afraid it could be a problem immediately again. So,
well, we'll see.
We'll see.
We'll see if the rest of the organization feels the same way.
Ladies and gentlemen, joining us now is a man who's got a massive brain.
Mike Florio.
He used to be a lawyer, then he decided to take his talents to the internet.
NBC Sports.
I'm sorry I'm late. I was talking to Robert Kraft.
That isn't the time for an airing of grievances.
Pro Football Talk.
I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're going to hear about it.
On Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
It is Wednesday. It is 11 o'clock. It is 12 o'clock Eastern time, which means he has pushed back his lunch for us. We go to the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline, CircaLasVegas.com. That is where we find Mike Florio, who usually also joins us on Twitch, twitch.tv/Chicago670TheScore. Mike, now we have to always ask, what's the plan for lunch today?
There is none, unfortunately. But there's no feeling better than knowing that your stomach is growling. Like, it gives you an energy that carries you through whatever it is you're doing. And sometimes it's almost like the Seinfeld episode where they're test driving the car and they want to see how far they can push it past E. Yes. Sometimes I get tempted to see how long I can ride out this discomfort of being hungry. But I know I can do it for 20 more minutes.
All right, I feel like that's fair. Any more than 20 minutes, and I feel like you start to get into the hangry category.
Yeah, I think a lot of people get hangry, and then people don't know how to deal with that growling in the stomach. I just push through, and I'm like, I'll eat when I eat. But it's interesting that that gets you to a certain level. Mike, speaking of getting to levels, we got a trade.
Yeah.
And I'm so fascinated by the trade itself and what it could mean larger picture, because, you know, we stay on Aaron Rodgers' watch, as I know you do too. So can you give us just what the parameters of why the Steelers are moving on from their most valuable wide receiver?
Well, for the past half hour or so, I've been working back through some of the specific points in the relationship between the Steelers and George Pickens that made this trade seem inevitable. There was an incident after a Thursday night game between the Steelers and the Titans in 2023 that created a dust-up between Pickens and the Steelers. And Mike Tomlin said, this is a pebble in my shoe, which I think he meant to downplay it. But if you ever had a pebble in your shoe, it's not a pleasant experience. There were incidents throughout the 2024 season. Remember, after the Christmas Day loss to the Steelers, he showed up during the interview post game when they were wearing the giant red Santa coats, Patrick Mahomes and Travis Kelce. And it had a come get me vibe to it. After they lost in the playoffs, he was asked, Pickens was, by reporters, are you optimistic about the offense going forward? He said, nah. So it really seemed like it was moving in this direction. And I think the key was when the Steelers trade for DK Metcalf and give him a 5-year, $150 million contract, that's a sign to Pickens, you're not getting paid, not by us. And I said that day, he is getting traded. Now it got quiet. And I think part of the problem was there wasn't a land rush for Pickens, because I think people around the league would look at this and say, man, Mike Tomlin is really good at keeping guys who could be an issue under control, and he's having trouble with Pickens. What's it going to be like for us? But at the end of the day, Cowboys get him, Cowboys want him, and now the Cowboys are going to have to figure out how to strike this balance. Keep him happy, get the most out of him. When do we pay him? How do we get him enough football so he's happy when he's clearly number two to CeeDee Lamb? This thing has a lot of layers and levels. And it really is a calculated risk by the Cowboys.
Yeah, there's a couple of truths here, though. And I think you just hit on one of them, Mike. Number one, the Steelers will find a way to get value for people even after they haven't had as much value to them. We sit here in Chicago knowing what happened with Chase Claypool. Stands to be repeated in this window. I think one of the first thoughts I had was, if George Pickens isn't right for this, what's going to happen next? I felt like I had that thought somewhere during the season last year. It was probably around that time. It was only a matter of time at that point, right? At that point, you knew they were going to move him. The other part of this is the Cowboys love trading for receivers. Yeah, this is something that I feel like is a time-honored tradition. Unfortunately, going back to what they paid for Amari Cooper, at least this time around, we understand it's a 2026 third rounder and a 27 fifth rounder. That makes it make sense. You know, and I feel like with the Cowboys treating their run game the way they are, they're going to have to pass more in order to try to win. So maybe there is enough for everybody.
And if CeeDee Lamb gets double covered, George Pickens running single coverage down the sideline, we know how effective he is at tracking and catching deep balls. He's immensely talented. And one of the criticisms I've had for the Steelers during their 3 years with George Pickens is very similar to one of the criticisms I had for the Seahawks during their years with DK Metcalf. When you have a guy like that, you need to find a way to get the ball in his hands. Your offense needs to be premised on finding a way to get him involved early, to get the most out of him, to get defenses to shade coverage toward him so the rest of the offense opens up. And I feel like the Steelers never fully embraced it. The quarterback is going to be the key, though. We had Jason Garrett, the former Cowboys coach, on PFT Live today once the news broke. And kudos to the Cowboys for knowing when to drop this. 6:30 a.m. Eastern time, command coverage all day long of this story, take over the news cycle, brilliant by the Cowboys. And we got Garrett on, and he said the key is going to be Dak Prescott to managing this relationship, getting the right tone, getting the right balance, getting Pickens to buy into whatever his role is, because he's going to want the ball enough times to earn a second contract with the Cowboys or with someone else. Well, CeeDee Lamb's already the number one receiver, so how's that going to work? And I think that's one of the reasons why the Steelers had to move on. Once you make Metcalf the number one receiver, Pickens isn't going to get the number of targets that he needs to go out and get a $30 million a year contract somewhere else. So the Cowboys really need to find the right way to make this work. And it could be as simple as quarterback. When you look at the quarterbacks Pickens had during his 3 years in Pittsburgh, it was all post Roethlisberger. It was Kenny Pickett. It was Russell Wilson, who isn't what Russell Wilson used to be, and others. It really, I think, underscores, number one, the importance of the quarterback making it work, and number two, the possibility that perhaps Dak Prescott can do it.
At least Dak Prescott has weapons. Meanwhile, we've got a weapon in DK Metcalf, wondering who will be the quarterback. I mean, you just posted a story about Aaron Rodgers, kind of the latest as we all kind of keep eyes on it. What can you tell us about where you're seeing this Aaron Rodgers situation, whether it's heating up or is it pretty much we're still on a treadmill right now?
I was told before the draft from someone in a position to know, and I know Aaron Rodgers prides himself on no one knowing anything about him under any set of circumstances. That's just an unrealistic and naive view of how people operate. Everybody tells someone else something they're not supposed to tell anyone under a strict vow of secrecy, and then that person inevitably tells one person under that same vow of secrecy. That's just how human beings are. So I was told before the draft that Rodgers to the Steelers will happen. The question is, when? And then during the draft, Art Rooney II, the owner of the team, says he wants to come here. And that kind of got obscured by the whole Shedeur Sanders slide and the prank call and everything else that happened that weekend. But I think that's a pretty important statement. I think at this point, he's waiting until the schedule is locked. And look, the schedule comes out next Wednesday. At some point before Wednesday, the NFL can't do anything about changing it. But when you look at the schedule the Jets got last year, and Mike North, who's in charge of putting the schedule together, came out and said the Jets owe us one. You know, if Rodgers to the Steelers is a done deal, they might get more primetime, short week, jerked around the schedule games early in the year. And whatever anyone says about it, it complicates your effort to win games when you've got Sunday to Thursday twice in the first half of the season like the Jets did. So I think at some point at or around the time the schedule comes out or just after it, that's when I think Rodgers is going to join the Steelers. OTAs start May 27. I think he does it by then. And the name to watch by way of a potential acquisition is Alan Lazard, because we know how good he is with Rodgers and how good he isn't without Rodgers. And he renegotiated his contract with the Jets down to a $2.5 million salary for this year. That becomes very attractive to a Steelers team that suddenly has DK Metcalf and a bunch of guys behind him.
You know, it's not a bad thought about Lazard, too, because even though in my brain he's over 30, he's only 29. That's a movable asset for any team.
especially since we've seen what he does with Rodgers. Rodgers is big on guys he can trust, guys who he knows will catch the ball when he throws it to them, even if they seem to be covered. Lazard is big enough that he can do that. And there's that relationship. That relationship is so important. So if you're going to be dropping Aaron Rodgers into a new situation where he doesn't really know anyone, now, that doesn't mean that Rodgers gets to be GM and brings in Nathaniel Hackett and Devontae Adams, too late for that. Randall Cobb's still out there. Who knows if Cobb becomes a member of the Steelers? But there's something to be said about making things comfortable for Aaron Rodgers. You want comfort for Rodgers, and you need production in the receiver room. Right now, the best thing they have behind Metcalf is Robert Woods, who arguably best days behind him. They've got some journeymen like Scotty Miller and Ben Skowronek. They've got Calvin Austin III, who can be a great, you know, specialized niche player. I'm not going to be surprised if not long after Rodgers officially signs with the Steelers send something to the Jets to get Alan Lazard, who really doesn't have value to them without Rodgers there.
Steelers clearly playing some chess instead of checkers if they're waiting for that schedule release before they worry about signing Aaron Rodgers. I'm curious, because that schedule release a week from today, people have been talking here about the Bears opening against the defending world champion Philadelphia Eagles. Do you think that's the most likely thing to happen?
You know, I haven't looked at the Eagles' schedule recently, which means I don't know.
Okay.
But I'd love to see Washington-Philly rematch right out of the gates. They're not big on division rivalries in week one, but it's not unprecedented. That is going to be an interesting test, because there are going to be some compelling home game possibilities for the Eagles throughout the course of the season. Will the NFL burn one on a night when they really don't need to? I'm always curious about what the NFL does for its biggest games that will draw a big audience, regardless of who is playing against the good team. Thanksgiving, for example, is it a great game or is it an okay game? Because even an okay game is going to get 40 million people. That's going to be an interesting one to look at. But the Bears are in play because the Bears kind of have that quality now where people are interested. And in the event that it doesn't work, you may as well get their marquee games on national TV early before we find out that another year of hype melts into another year of something less than what people were hoping for.
Mike, just so you know what the other out-of-division games are as far as home options, it's the Bears, the Broncos, the Lions, the Raiders, and the Rams. Those would be your other options outside of the division for the Eagles.
A Rams rematch would be compelling because of all the teams they faced in the postseason last year.
And the
Eagles
run.
Didn't have the bye, so they played four. The Rams were the only team that gave them a good game.
Okay.
Absolutely. And the difference was, as we know, partially, Jalen Carter, that game-wrecking three technique. I say that because it reminds me of now Abdul Carter asking for a retired jersey number, which I think is out of pocket to do so against.
These kids have no manners.
Lawrence Taylor, of all people, to acquire about number 56. And I know he also acquired about number 11. I understand that this is going to happen with the passage of time. But what were your thoughts when you heard about that entire discussion?
Well, my general thought is, teams shouldn't retire jerseys. There's got to be a better way to honor someone who was great, because there's only so many, and there's up to 90 guys who need uniforms at any one time for NFL teams. Not that there's 90 dressed, but you've got 90 on the roster up until right before the start of the regular season. Everyone needs to have a number. So that can become an issue. I believe if you're going to retire jerseys, you have to stick to it. And I think the teams should be the gatekeepers here. The Giants have some fault for this because they facilitate it. They encourage it. And it's one thing for a Peyton Manning to go to Denver after he's worn 18 for over a decade and he's already a Hall of Famer, and they convince Frank Trapuca to unretire number 18 for Manning, or J.J. Watt to go from Houston to Arizona and they convince Marshall Goldberg's family to unretire number 99. Now we're seeing guys who are stepping into the league as rookies with no experience in the NFL getting retired numbers. The Giants did it last year with Malik Nabers. They gave him number one. It's been retired for Ray Flaherty. This year, Cam Ward gets number one with the Titans, retired for Warren Moon. Although that one's different because that was Oilers. He never played for the Titans. So it's a little easier to distinguish, but what if these guys who come in end up having careers that justify retiring their jerseys? That makes it very awkward down the road. What do you do? Do you retire it for both players at that point? I'm a believer that Abdul Carter and any player coming into the league should pick a number that currently means nothing to the team and then dedicate himself to making that number mean everything.
I think that that's a good way to look at the motivation. This segment is brought to you by AlmostFreeTeeth.com. Save on dental implants today.
We're joined by Mike Floyer, creator and editor-in-chief of Pro Football Talk. We're talking a lot about kind of fallout of the draft, and one of the things that was brought up to me, I'm trying to remember who told me about this possibility. I think it was David Haw on the morning show. This idea that the draft is just isn't big enough, right? And that they could go to some type of week-long draft where media night is on Monday and then the first round is on Tuesday, the second round is on Wednesday, Thursday is the... Do you see a scenario in which the NFL expands draft week to make it an all-week thing? Mike, is that a thing on your radar, or are we just wishcast? Oh, no.
Yeah. Well, Ben Fisher of Sports Business Journal had an item earlier this week, and it's one of those... I keep a list of all the stories I'd like to get to, and then reality intervenes and George Pickens gets traded and things that are on the list. They usually stay there until Saturday when things finally slow down and then I can catch up. But Ben Fisher reported that the NFL wants to, at least for now, spill that crowd into Wednesday and Sunday. Not necessarily with rounds of the draft, but with events that will get people to show up at the venue on Wednesday and on Sunday so they can pump up the numbers higher and higher. And I need to say one thing. I don't want to be Debbie Downer here, but the NFL loves to inflate the attendance of the draft into something that seems larger than it is. They'll say this year there were 600,000 fans that attended the draft in Green Bay. Well, it's not 600,000 different people. You've got the same people coming back day after day. And when you see the numbers for Saturday, the numbers for Saturday were bigger than the numbers for Thursday, which seems ridiculous if you saw shots of the crowd. Here's what happens. There's a perimeter set up somewhere at the draft site, and there's no charge. So people go in and out all day long, especially on a Saturday. Got to go to the car, got to go to the bathroom, got to go get something to eat. Every time you go back in, you get counted again. So one person can get counted once each day, multiple times each day. That's how they get to these massive numbers that they embrace. And I wish they didn't do that. Like, the real numbers would be good enough. It's an impressive sight on Thursday night. But once the Packers made their pick on Thursday night, that place cleared out pretty fast. But they want to take those numbers and add Wednesday and Sunday. And look, I think you're onto something. Round one, one night. Round two, the next night. Round three, the next night. And then at some point, you just got to do the rest of them, because really, by the time we get to round five, six, seven, I'm sorry. I know it's my job to follow this stuff. After Shedeur Sanders got picked and all the dust settled on that, I was done. I'll check the list of all the players who were drafted once it's over.
Mike, we have to pick up the torch, because the way we talk about our seventh round running back pick, Kyle Monongo out of Rutgers that the Bears had, it's definitely us. Like, it comes down to the media who covers the local team. So we're picking up that torch for you. What did you think? I know we're up against a break. What did you think really quickly of just the announcement of the schedule at the draft, by the way? That was something that I gave pause to. I don't know that it was really necessary in the way it was presented.
Every time something like that happens, I think of the scene from The Office where Angela says, "Stay tuned for a very important announcement about your paychecks. They will be issued at the usual time in the normal amount." Like, it's an announcement about nothing, and it felt like it was being crammed into the captive audience. But the NFL has realized there are tent poles out there in the offseason when they're not playing games, and they've crafted these events that otherwise mean nothing into something. And the schedule release will be a huge deal, because even though we know the who and the where of every game, the when is critical, especially for a team that needs to get off to a good start. Can we get some easy games early? Can we get out to 3-1 before we hit the teeth of the schedule? How many of these short weeks do we have? How many primetime home games do we have? For the people who attend the games, when do I plan the trip here? When do I plan the trip there? And now we know late season, any of those games can get jerked around from Sunday to Thursday to Monday to here and there, which shows that the NFL really doesn't care nearly as much about the fans who attend the games as it does about creating big events that 20 million plus will tune into on the networks, the cable channels, or on any of the streaming platforms where the games are broadcast.
Mike Florio from Pro Football Talk, thank you for joining us here on Raheem and Harris on The Score.
Lunchtime.